With all three bridges destroyed leading to the eastern Ukrainian city of Severodonetsk, can support still reach its defenders?
So the bridges remain unavailable for the moment. However, Ukrainian forces, they still fight, they still defend, and very heavy fightings are going on.
Plus, what are some of the challenges facing Ukraine as Russian forces continue making advances in the Donbass?
The Russians have about a 10-to-1 advantage. The real issue is that the Ukrainian forces are depleting their stocks.
And later in the program, how one puppy is helping children recover from the trauma of war. Today is Tuesday, June 14th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller.
And I'm Michael Lippin. Ukrainian authorities say Russian forces have destroyed the last bridge linking the besieged eastern city of Severodonetsk to western Ukraine. More bodies also have been discovered in a suburb of the Ukrainian capital Kyiv, where Russian troops are suspected of slaughtering residents before retreating in March. I spoke to reporter Anna Chernikova, who is in Kyiv, and she told me that while the loss of the bridges is a blow to the defenders of Severodonetsk, they're still able to keep up the fight.
So yesterday we got confirmation from the military that all the bridges that connect Severodonetsk in the area are destroyed. So basically, just for the understanding that Luhansk and Donetsk region, there are a lot of rivers there, and there is one huge river which is called Siversky Donets, and this is one of the main logistics point as well, because Russian forces are trying to reach the river and cross the river, and they're not successful. So this river is extremely important, and it creates a lot of difficulties for both sides. However, military officials highlight that the situation with transporting the injured soldiers is fine. So there are ways, and there are other ways also to bring humanitarian aid when needed. So the bridges remain unavailable for the moment. However, Ukrainian forces, they still fight, they still defend, and very heavy fightings are going on. What we know for the moment that Ukrainians continue to control the industrial area of the city and also a couple of building blocks. But again, situation is changing very, very fast. And this creates also, complications with the analysis of the situation. But we definitely know that for Russian forces, there are a lot of losses and there are a lot of complications that they didn't expect.
So, Anna, what are those other ways that the Ukrainian military can get supplies into its forces in Severodonetsk without crossing those bridges?
So there are still ways remaining, and we know this from the official sources. They're not announced, but we know that one of the ways is basically through the river. So it's longer. It makes additional complications, but there is still possible. So it just, using the river as one of the routes. But also there are some, other ways that unfortunately we cannot talk about or we cannot ask about because it's apparently something that military is not telling.
Understood. Anna, what can you also tell us about the situation in the town of Bucha that the Russian forces withdrew from back in March after many of the residents were killed?
We know that there are still works ongoing to find bodies, and a lot of bodies are still found either, in the underground, like in the basements of the buildings, or somewhere in the forest, in the green areas. We know that yesterday, another mass grave was found in Bucha, and bodies which were found in that mass grave are bodies of people who were tortured and executed. So they have holes in their knees, they have bullet holes in the in their head. So basically what experts said, preliminary results, is that they were tortured and then killed, executed. And also their hands were knitted down behind. So this is basically what we know. And this is happening all the time. And also what civilians are telling, that time to time, bodies are found. So even when you go to for a walk with your dog, you can just find a body. Or sometimes there are also stories that dogs just bring, you know, parts of the body. So this is basically what's happening for the moment.
So the conflict is not just happening in eastern Ukraine. I understand Russia was also targeting parts of western Ukraine. What happened today?
Today Ukraine was under a massive missile attack. So almost every region except of Kherson region was under the air raid siren for a couple of hours. And it was a massive missile attack on the west part of Ukraine. So it's Ternopil region and Lviv region. This is what we know for the moment. We know that air defense was working and working successfully. So for the moment, we have confirmed information that all the missiles were destroyed by the air defense. Some parts of the missiles fall in Lviv region and damaged a brick plant. 4 people are injured, including a child, but the injuries are not too heavy. So people should be fine, at least for the moment. And in Ternopil region, there is no confirmation or any details about any damages. So we just know that all the missiles were destroyed.
Reporter Anna Chernikova in Kiev, thank you for that update.
Thank you.
Ukraine continues pleading with the West to send more and better artillery to combat Russian forces in the Donbas region. Speaking to Danish journalists online on Tuesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky repeated as such, saying, quote, "What we don't have enough of are weapons that really hit the range that we need to reduce the advantage of the Russian Federation's equipment," end quote. Now, according to a presidential advisor on Monday, Ukraine says it needs is 1,000 howitzers, 500 tanks, and 1,000 drones. And that's in addition to other heavy weapons. Several countries have also promised to send weapons, including advanced long-range U.S. missile systems, but deploying them is taking time. So, what's the importance of these heavy weapons to the battles currently on the field? Well, that's the question I put to Jason Davidson, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, as well as a political science and international affairs professor at the University of Mary Washington in Virginia.
Well, it's incredibly important at this moment. It hasn't been and wasn't in the early stages of the war, but at this moment, what we are really seeing is primarily an artillery war, particularly from the perspective of Ukraine, what Ukraine can do both to hold the territory that it currently has and try to regain some of the territory that it doesn't control is mostly artillery as a means to counter the Russians. Now, the Russians have the additional advantage of the advantage in air power, but from Ukraine's perspective, it's overwhelmingly artillery, and part of that is because the Russians have gotten smarter about staying back from close combat. One of the mistakes that they were making earlier on. But of course, as I think has been pretty widely established at this point, the Russians have about a 10-to-1 advantage in terms of their ability to both artillery systems and then rounds of artillery in the. The real issue is that the Ukrainian forces are depleting their stocks of munitions.
But on that notion of an imbalance between the amount of artillery that Russia has and Ukraine has, the West, the United States, the UK, NATO, they're all saying that they're going to provide additional means to Ukraine. But, you know, what are some of the logistical challenges? Because it's not just getting the equipment there. There's also training that has to factor in this because these are new weapon systems for Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a major challenge. It's a logistical challenge. Even if you put aside everything else, there's a logistical challenge of, as you said, getting them to Ukraine, but also and let's remember, too, it's not just a question of getting, let's say, with howitzer systems or these HIMARS, it's not that the United States has both already deployed and has promised it's going to deploy these HIMARS. It's not just a question of getting the Ukrainian military capable of firing these weapons, but they've also got to be maintained and conceivably, you know, repaired. And there's all those sorts of things that go along with it, because you get to a certain point in extended use where you're going to have to do all those sorts of things. And as we saw in Afghanistan, without the support by the U.S. for either training somebody how to maintain and repair these things, or you know, on site, and that's of course not going to happen in Ukraine. On site maintenance and repair, upkeep, all those sorts of things. So that's a real challenge, and it's hard to see how that can change in the near term. What I've heard people say, and I think it's a fair point, is that certainly if steps had been taken, you know, a month ago or 2 months ago, that would make it easier. But we are where we are now, and it's hard to see that changing.
Jason Davidson is a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's also a political science professor at the University of Mary Washington. Jason, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Ukrainian authorities have promised to restore everything the Russians have destroyed. But many residents aren't waiting for that. Anna Rice has that story.
Everything got damaged. My son has cleaned it up already. Well, yes, I cried a lot because everything got destroyed.
Ukrainian authorities have promised to restore all the damaged residential buildings and already allotted 1 billion hryvnia, nearly $34 million, for that purpose.
Currently, we have 400 million hryvnia to do restoration work. Will that be enough to let people get back to their restored homes? No, it won't be enough.
According to the Kyiv School of Economics, it's going to cost upwards of $39 billion to restore the damaged residential buildings in Ukraine. But many here say they can't wait for that and have started doing some of the rebuilding work themselves. A volunteer rebuilding battalion called Dobrobat is helping.
People can leave a message like, who can come and help me restore my home? Volunteers put out those messages through Telegram channels, and whoever is free can respond and help.
Applications can be left on the Dobrobat website. There is a special form for volunteers who put in the help they can offer. Longtime construction worker Vadim Lavrik has put together a special team in the Sumy region. In the first 26 hours, more than 30 volunteers signed up.
Young women help us as well. One of them is probably 21. She hardly weighs more than 50 kilos. I often tell her, take just one brick at a time. They're too heavy for you. Another woman who helps us is an industrial engineer. Very different people, but all are incredibly talented.
So far, more than 27,000 people have volunteered to help. At the moment, Dobrobat is operating in the Kyiv, Chernihiv, and Sumy regions. Volunteers work in teams a few days a week. Volunteers mostly either clear debris or restore residential buildings.
If a person's roof is broken, the whole house will get damaged. It'll be filled with rainwater. It'll be impossible to live in. And when you think of it, all is needed is go over there, put some profiled sheeting on, and fix the roof. And we have a family living in their own home again.
While there is no shortage of volunteers, there is a shortage of materials and gas. That's why Dobrobat members are on the constant lookout for sponsors and funds. Banks and IT companies are helping as well. Dobrobat founders are creating a map with all the damaged buildings on it and looking for sponsors for each project.
After the appraisal is done, all the documentation and a brief description is uploaded to our website for the potential sponsors to see. Then we, of course, add the end pictures and all the financial accounts.
The Dobrobat founders plan to add more rebuilding battalions in the Kharkiv and Mykolaiv regions of Ukraine. Олеся Бакалець, Anna Rice, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The European Union's executive arm is expected to decide soon whether to recommend that Ukraine be granted candidate status for EU membership. The EU Commission, which must unanimously approve the recommendation, is set to debate the issue at a summit on June 23rd and 24th. While some EU leaders have signaled support for the move, some member states are more reluctant. VOA's Miroslava Gungadze has the details.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, during her recent visit to Kyiv, met with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky to discuss the country's reconstruction and progress toward European Union membership, as the EU is set to debate the issue in the weeks ahead. The head of European Commission told Eastern European leaders, this month, it's in EU's strategic interest and the moral duty to welcome Ukraine into the 27-member group. Von der Leyen also said Ukraine would first have to meet EU standards and requirements.
No shortcuts, no wildcard. Standards and conditions have to be met, because this is true for all of us in the European Union, and we know on a daily basis how hard it is to keep these standards up among us 27.
Ukraine's long-standing effort to move closer to European Union helped spark the 2014 Revolution of Dignity, also known as the Maidan Revolution, after Ukraine's pro-Russian-backed leader, at the time, refused to sign a popular trade agreement with the EU. The deal was eventually signed. Days after Russia's February 24th invasion of Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky sent a letter to start the process of attaining candidate status. But some EU members, including the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Austria, are reluctant to grant Ukraine candidate status. Ukraine First Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, Emina Japarova, told VOA that reluctance is an EU internal issue.
The main is that it is not about Ukraine, it is something that is about within EU as a crisis of vision, as a crisis of the future of the EU, with the special stress that there is the waiting list of countries, especially when it comes to the Western Balkan countries, that have been waiting for so long.
Maria Mezentseva, who had the Ukrainian delegation to the Council of Europe, says Ukraine has completed 63% of the terms in the EU Association Agreement, which is used to bring countries in the region closer to EU standards and norms.
It's going to be a green sign for Ukraine and the project of the EU, which started back in 1950s, for the purpose of promoting peace, preserving peace, and creating a club for peace. So the green light for us and the green light for the further integration and development, and the red card for Putin, so he can't say, you know, look, but you are not wanted there.
The U.S. ambassador to the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, Michael Carpenter, told VOA that Ukraine's integration with the West is also in America's interest.
This is the best way for Ukraine to anchor itself in a set of institutions that preserve its democracy, its sovereignty, its territorial integrity, and all the attributes of independence that we support and have long supported inside Ukraine.
After Ukraine emerged from the war, Carpenter says it will rebuild to become a stronger, more resilient, and united country than before. Miroslava Gungadze, VOA News, Warsaw.
British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said Tuesday she would do whatever was necessary to secure the release of two British nationals who have been sentenced to death by Russian proxy authorities in Donbass. Last week, two Britons and a Moroccan who were captured while fighting for Ukraine were sentenced to death by a court in the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. The Kremlin said Tuesday it was sure that Russian-backed separatist leaders in the Donbass would be willing to listen to Britain's appeal.
After many Western companies left Russia in response to its aggression on Ukraine, Moscow opened the first of the restaurants that are meant to replace those of the American firm McDonald's. The rebranded Russian version, and some do call it a knockoff, aims not only to serve hamburgers, but to be an affirmation of Russia's self-sufficiency and defiance. Marcus Harton narrates this report from Moscow.
There was much expectation in Moscow to see what the new restaurant that will take the place of McDonald's would be like, once the American firm decided to permanently leave after Russia's assault on Ukraine. Alexander Govor, a Siberian mining tycoon, is the oligarch who decided to revive the 800 restaurants left behind, with a menu now almost entirely with local ingredients. Behind the hamburgers, there is also a political message.
Without a doubt, I am a patriot. That is fundamental for me. But this is not directed against anyone, not against America or any other country.
After 3 months closed, the place reopens its doors under the name of Vkusno and Tochka, which could be translated as tasty, and that's it. Although customers interviewed said they will continue to use the name of the American firm.
I think we'll keep calling it McDonald's.
The new restaurant, with a menu largely copied from its predecessor, was sold out on its first day, with mixed reaction from fans of the American-style fast food.
I've tried everything, hot, cold, salty, and sweet. Everything is good.
I really liked the previous brand image, its color and its strength. Now everything seems more sedate, sadder.
McDonald's arrived in the Soviet Union 32 years ago as the country was opening to the world. It is now leaving the Russian market indefinitely, but it is also leaving behind an unmistakable imprint of American culture. Marcus Hartman, VOA News.
As we've discussed earlier on this program, several NGOs are on the ground in Ukraine providing much-needed mental health care to people of all ages. Reuters' Ilan Rubens rounds us out today with this story of one facility using pets as part of their therapeutic care plan.
Yevsei, a black and white spaniel, waits patiently as kids gather around to pet him every day. He's part of a dog therapy session in eastern Ukraine, where canines help children adjust to a life after war. Yevsei is one of 28 dogs at a humanitarian aid center in Zaporizhia, where children also draw, sing nursery rhymes, and receive psychological support. Olga Pivtoratska is a volunteer at the Dr. Doc Therapy Center.
It is important for them because a child's psyche is very vulnerable to the war, which is going on right now. They are very anxious because of it. Some children are very scared, and we help them to come out of this state of mind. We help them to adapt to the fact that it is quiet here in Zaporizhia, that there are no explosions, nothing to remind them of what they went through.
Another dog, Melo, has arrived at the same humanitarian center, alongside owner Daniil Savchenko, who traveled hundreds of miles from eastern Ukraine to flee bombardment.
So we came with my mother from Berdyansk. Actually, right now there are Russian soldiers and Russian flags all around the city. We are quite afraid of it, and I would actually go to army if not my mom, because I don't want to let her live without me.
Nearby are piles of clothes and other humanitarian aid. Many of the refugees have come from regions further east, where the bulk of the fighting between Ukrainian and Russian forces is taking place. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which it calls a special military operation, has killed thousands and displaced millions. Staff say the volunteers look after their children while the parents register, before moving on to permanent homes.
That was Ilan Rubens of Reuters News.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media feeds. You can just follow us at VOA News. On behalf of Michael Lippin and the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.